This is a Glassbox Media podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we talk to well-known guests about their lives, their careers, and navigating those difficult moments on the way. I'm Giles Paley-Phillips, and with me on this bank holiday Monday is when we're recording, Jim Daly.
We've really set ourselves now. We've dated the pod within the first 20 seconds. If this pod doesn't go out immediately, people will be like, what is up with these guys? This one might be later in the week. This is an Easter-y, relaxed Easter-y episode. So yeah. Just whenever.
Yeah.
We're just cool and breezy.
Easter's a bit like, it's not quite as extreme as the Christmas time, you know, when you don't know what day of the week it is.
Yeah.
But Easter's a bit like that.
Well, we've still got a four-day weekend.
Yeah.
Which we're now coming towards the end of. So that basically feels like a week off for people. Mm. So, and I know a lot of my friends that do full-time work, and obviously I don't, are quite strategic with their days off. So a lot of people will take another day off this week, or maybe a few, two or three days off, and then end of last week, and then it feels like you've got a decent old chunk off. So people might be in that kind of, that post-Christmas, New Year window where you don't know what's going on. So we're just going to be cool and breezy with this episode, and it'll go out when it goes out.
Yeah, absolutely. But bank holidays are a bit weird, aren't they, I think, anyway? They feel like not quite as bad as Christmas Day, but it's that bit where, like, no one seems to be around and shops are kind
of... You say that by being the dad of a toddler... bank holiday means that this week there's no nursery available, I'm having to see who's around. We are booking in play dates galore this week. Last week I was in sole custody of the youngest, and now we've got both kids and we've got to try and find time to fill with them. So if anyone's out there fancies a play date, get in contact. We'll go to the park. But I do. The thing that always gets me back my holidays, and this is like pre-warning. This is a very stupid. It can make me sound very stupid. But I always have a moment, nearly every time, where I think, "Oh, I've got to pop to the bank," or "Oh, I've got to pop to the post office," and then I remember they're all closed because it's literally called bank holiday. But I, for some reason, it always pops around those times. But I think, I don't know. Maybe it's being freelancer that you just don't know. The concept of days off don't exist, but I really need to go to the post office literally this weekend, and I've timed it terribly.
That is bad timing. Have you got something desperate to go out? Sneaky.
Yeah.
That's
never mind.
That's a sort of little mini tragedy there.
It'll go tomorrow. It'll be fine. Again, like this episode, it's not life and death.
Exactly.
It just happens when it happens.
That person will get this item, you know,
when they get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
And if they start moaning, you say, well, it's bank holiday. You shouldn't have bought it.
Bank holiday. It's your own fault for relying on me to try and get something posted inside.
You bought it knowing that it was going to be delivered over the bank holiday.
You bought it from me.
Yeah.
Which, of course, knowing that it's going to be delayed massively.
I'm massively assuming this is probably a Vinted negotiation.
No comment, because other... selling websites are available and they've not sponsored this episode.
It does seem to be a big thing at the moment, though, more than the other one that people have traditionally used.
Which is also very good.
Yeah.
Should we say the name? We shouldn't say anything.
No.
I'm actually, while I'm here recording in the cabin, I'm going to go look through my boxes, multiple boxes of football shirts, because I've decided to try and sell a few, because I've grown out of... I put one on the other day and I've like two sizes too small for me.
Okay. So
they're going to start going out on. So if people like football shirts, follow me on social media and I'll start sending links because, need to make a bit of money as well. So, you know, the old double whammy of being too fat and too poor.
I had to sell a guitar the other day. just
remember you told me that,
because I needed to replace some equipment. So, you know, it's a one in, one out kind of negotiation.
Exactly. Like a nightclub.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to be like that when I wear football shirts, I think, because I did find another really lovely vintage Palace shirt on one of those websites the other day. Mm. But now my theory is one in, one out.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try and limit myself to my football shirts to a certain number.
Like so you can't go over that
at a nightclub.
Yeah.
I think that would be sensible. Yeah. I'm probably at near triple figures. I think 50 would be a sensible amount
for
football shirts. So I'm gonna get rid of quite a few, actually. Bit of a spring clear out.
So you're over capacity at the moment. People are crammed in
massively. They're like, yeah, it's dangerous in there.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. You need to start.
I got to think of the safety of my football shirts. Yeah. I got to let the nice ones breathe, because again, you know, there's some in there that are lovely, and there's some in there that are a bit rougher.
Yeah.
And you don't want. I sound so elitist with this stupid analogy. I want to let the nicer ones breathe.
Yeah.
Where's this going?
I don't know.
Anyway, follow me for football shirts.
if you want some premium football shirts, try and find Jim on selling websites.
I'll put the links on social media and stuff, so follow me on my socials, and I'll if you happen to be a football shirt collector, which I've become unintentionally.
Anyway, we should probably talk about this week's guest, because the thing is, this is a podcast. Not talking about selling our wares. What an amazing guest. Absolutely thrilled to have Maureen Baig on, who is a broadcaster and an influencer, I guess, to a certain extent, but certainly she has spent a lot of her time in working in education, and we talk a lot about that and her time working in schools and the impact that it's had on her life and the impact she's had on other people's lives.
Yeah, massively, absolutely. I was about to say sort of an education icon. I don't know if that's a thing, but
it
feels like she is. It is now. Yeah, we've created it. And clearly really passionate about that sector, and has taken that into her broadcasting work, and done some fantastic programs, and is now working on her own YouTube series, which is called Glow Up Your Grades, which, as you say, is literally helping kids with their GCSEs. So, which is absolutely fantastic. And as you said, really, really helping people. But also just a lovely, lovely person. Like, really, really easy to talk to. Was loads of fun. With our recent episodes, we've been sort of focusing, I think, more on sort of niche areas. And this is, but I think the pod really benefits from that, being able to bury down into one area. And this is definitely one we haven't gone to before. Maureen, what a fantastic guest.
Yeah, really fantastic. And you can tell her passion straight away when she's talking about these things. You know, we have guests on who kind of light up when they're talking about these things.
Yeah.
And obviously something that, you know, that we can talk about the political side of stuff, but, you know, the education system is such a big part of, you know, our cultural and societal landscape. And, you know, whatever sort of side of the political fence you sit, we all want the best for our children, with regards to their education. And, you know, there are lots of different ways of doing things, and perhaps we might all, you know, you and I might agree that the current state of affairs isn't maybe the ideal one. At the end of the day, you know, at the end of the day, it's the kids that are important. And Maureen's doing amazing work and has continued to do amazing work with helping and supporting young people.
Yeah, and at one point she goes on a bit of a rant and then apologises and says, oh, I'm sorry for going on a rant. But we're both like, no, that's exactly what this pod's about. And that passion comes through. Yeah. It really, really does. And that's exactly what we're trying to create with this pod, is a safe space for people to talk passionately about subjects that they care about. And it's exactly what happens. So really, really interesting. And then talks, you know, a lot about moving into the broadcasting space and talking about the highs and the lows of that, the frustrations, the wins. And so that's also, two areas covered here, really. Mm. And before, we've had education come up before in passing with people talking about their own experiences of school and stuff, but this is the first time I've had, I think, a real expert on the subject, and I think that's why we're able to give it a bit more time to sort of bury down into it. So an interesting and an informative episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we should dive in.
Yeah, let's do it. This is the fantastic Maureen Baig on the Blank Podcast.
Hello,
Mehreen, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Did I say it wrong that time?
You made it sound right? A little bit French this time, actually.
It did, didn't it? I'm so sorry.
He really went for it. But, bonjour.
But I enjoyed it. It's, yeah, I always
yeah. Have well, thank you for being kind. Thank you for coming on the podcast. I kind of wanted to start with your journey into education, really, because I'm the husband of a teacher who works in a secondary school. She's a design technology teacher, and I obviously hear a lot about the pros and cons of being in the education system in this country. Was that something you always saw yourself going into?
No. I always thought I was going to be a doctor.
Okay.
Because I'm Pakistani and it was kind of assigned at birth. And for my A-levels, I did chemistry, biology, maths, English literature. But I had a bit of a rebel phase when I was in college. So I kind of was bunking off school a little bit and I didn't revise and work as hard as I should have. And I ended up missing my offer. I missed my medicine offer. So I thought, God, what do I do now? All my life, I knew I was going to be a doctor. What on earth do I do? So I went through clearing. It was a particular low point in my life. And I thought, well, there's a spot to do English. And I really love English. So I'll go and do English. And then while I was at uni, to make some extra money, in my second and third year, I started working at a tutoring centre on Saturdays. My sister's a teacher, my brother's a teacher. So it was kind of like I would go and help out in school plays or do extra little classes with the kids there in their schools. And it just, yeah, at the end of my third year, the penny dropped and I thought, I really like this and I'm really good at this and I don't know what else I'll do. So let me do a PGCE, I'll be a teacher. And I ended up doing that throughout my 20s. It was the best decision. You know, it's weird, isn't it? Like things go wrong. Like you fail your A-levels and you think it's like the worst thing in the world at the time. But I really do believe that like all the dots eventually add up. And so had I not failed my A-levels, I wouldn't have become a teacher. And becoming a teacher was the best thing to ever happen to me.
I completely agree. And actually, my journey was really similar because I failed my A-levels as well.
Sorry, Jim. I was going to say, what did you both do in your A-levels? And what were your grades? From someone who didn't do A-levels?
Chemistry, biology, maths and English.
Oh, God, they sound all really hard.
I got, three Bs and a C.
Okay. That's good.
So what about you, Jim?
Oh, my God, okay, I'm miles away from that. So I did ceramics.
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh. I didn't know that was a thing.
Didn't know either. I did ceramics. I did PE. I did communication studies, literally the other end of the spectrum, isn't it? I did general studies, which was a complete DOS, and I did French. And I got an A in communication studies. I failed ceramics in my first year. I failed French. I think I got an E in French. I got a C in general studies, and I failed PE. Because I thought PE was just playing football. It turns out it's a lot of biology. And I did not do well at that at all. And that was the only exam in my entire life where I've gone into the hall, opened up the paper, I thought, oh, I can't do that one. Oh, I can't do that one. Can't do that one. Oh, shit, that's the whole paper. I just sat there for 2 hours in silence because I couldn't answer any questions. It was horrifying.
I think A-levels then, are difficult, though. It's like it's such a huge jump from GCSEs and you're suddenly more independent and the school's not spoon-feeding you and... It's I think a lot of people, it is a shock. You kind of think, with GCSEs, you can almost, if you're bright enough, you can sometimes just coast through and you'll answer something because in the last 15, 16 years of your life, you would have learned some of that information. But it just doesn't work like that with A-levels.
No, you're right. The jump up is huge. Because I got an A at GCSE French and was like, oh my God, I'm basically French. And then did A-level. And the jump up was insane. I was like in class with like literally French people. And I really struggled. And again, going to a college where they're like, hey, you can go to class if you want to, if you don't want to. I was like, okay, I don't want to. So I just didn't go to any classes and then had to retake French second year. I did media studies in a year, basically had to like fill in the gaps for university and learned in that year that actually I did want to go and do journalism at university, having gone into my A-levels thinking I'm really arty, I'm gonna do ceramics, I'm gonna be, and so but again like you, like suddenly found through the failure essentially this other path. opened up, and it was communication studies at Oxford School, where I did my AS and A2. And my teacher, so I've turned this into the Jim Daly Show, haven't I? My teacher, Mrs. Ruffle, I never forget her. She was brilliant. And also, because on the bottom of her papers, it must have had her initial G, Ruffle, and then an A at the end for some reason. So it always said Gruffella, which always sounded to me like a sort of Julia Donaldson book. I always thought it was brilliant.
The Gruffella.
But yeah, there's always someone somewhere that inspires you, just sends you on a different path. And I ended up doing journalism and now obviously not doing that and doing madness, really. But sorry to hijack that.
Your
story is so familiar to me.
Yeah, no, it sounds very, very similar. But also, I think what you said about the fact that one teacher can unlock something, like, I think often we think we like a subject. But it's not that you like a subject. It's the fact that the teacher has the ability to turn something into your favorite subject or to turn something into your least favorite subject. And I really do feel like people kind of underestimate that. And the fact that you might hate maths in primary school and in secondary school, it becomes your favorite subject. Why is that? It's not because maths changed. It's because you had a teacher who inspired you. Or you had a teacher who was able to make that subject come to life for you.
Oh, it's so true. My son's, he's just about to do his GCSEs. So we were at his parents' evening last night and he's decided for A-levels, he wants to do computer science, BTEC IT, and then like photography, one creative subject.
Yeah.
And when we were with the computer science teacher, he was like, the BTEC, do you really need to be doing that as well as computer science? Like, it's probably a bit of a crossover. And then when we went to his biology teacher, he got a good grade in his mocks. She was like, You are going to be doing biology, aren't you, at A-level? And he's like, no, I don't want to do biology. And she said, oh, that's such a shame. And it just planted that little seed, and it was clear that he had a good rapport with this particular teacher. And then he was thinking, you know, you could just see the cogs turning, like thinking, oh, maybe I should do biology, actually. I'm quite good at it, and she's really nice. And it was that little thing, just like actually seeing his mind turning to doing something different. And I thought, that's really great, you know, and obviously she'd sown that seed as well.
And that is, and I think also as teachers you have, like, I don't think people always realise, like, the power you hold as a teacher with, like, the words you say to children, because, and I say this in my book, that you can say one thing and it will build a student for life. Like, they will remember that one thing that you told them that they're good at, or that one thing that's nice, that's good about them, and they will carry that and that will build them. But you can equally say one thing and it will break them and crush them and make them think they're rubbish. And sometimes you're human. You say things as, like, a throwaway comment. You might just say something as a joke or just something that is so minor to you. And 20 years later, a student gets in touch, and it happened to my sister. 20 years later, a student got in touch and was like, oh, you said this to me when I was in year 8 and it shaped what I, like, did for the rest of my life. And that's pretty, I mean, frightening. It's terrifying, but it's also, it's amazing. I still remember my year 11 parents' evening. I remember so clearly. I wasn't particularly close with any of my teachers. My sister taught me everything I know. But I remember on my last parents' evening, and parents' evening for us was like a family affair. It was mum, dad, brother, sister, cause everyone would come. It's like we Asians take over a hospital when they say only one visitor are allowed. Everyone is there. We're pulling extra chairs and we all sat down and she said, I know I'm going to see Maureen's name in shining lights one day. And I never forgot it. I never, ever forgot it. And she probably has, like, doesn't remember who I am, but I still remember that one moment. It stuck with me forever.
That's amazing. Words are so powerful, especially to young minds. Like, they are like sponges. And also, they're vulnerable and they're feeling, you know, we'll remember what it is to be 14, 15, 16. You feel so weird about yourself all the time. And that's why, you know, kids are really into music, because music talks to them, because there's certain words and they feel like that song's written only for them. And so I think you're absolutely right. Like, I remember primary school, I can't remember my teacher's name, but I remember writing a poem about my hamster, which I thought was, like, okay. And my teacher was like, this is so good. I'm going to enter this into a competition. Didn't win, didn't do well. But, like, that confidence there, you know, 33 years later, I'm still writing. Like, that obviously planted a seed, and I just think it's a real almost like a power. But as you say, it has to be dealt with carefully. I guess you can really toe either side of the line.
And even now, like, so I still volunteer in schools and tuition centres, and the GCSE cohort, this year's GCSE cohort, are the ones who spent two of the most important years of their education learning online. So they're, I think, like, GCSEs are always stressful, but it's particularly difficult this year. Yeah. And I sometimes mark kids' essays, and you don't always mark accurately, particularly like in English, you don't have to, it's subjective, there's no right or wrong, right? So you can give a slightly higher grade and get away with it. And I do try sometimes, and if I know someone needs a bit of a confidence boost, I'll give them like a grade higher and be like, this is amazing. I can't believe you've done this. Because that will give them the boost they need. And sometimes they go back to school and they're like, my teacher checked that essay and she said it was rubbish. She said it was a 5. And I'm like, why would you do that? Why would you not just let them believe, not all the time, but let them believe that that essay was incredible, because that would, it really, that a small thing like that makes them believe that, wow, I did it once, I can probably do it again, and they work harder the next time. You have got to be quite manipulative as a teacher. And emotionally intelligent and all those kind of things. You've got to really, yeah, every word you do, every action, and that can be really tough if you're having a tough day yourself, which obviously sometimes we go to work and you've had a rubbish morning, or you're getting divorced, or, you know, missed your bus in the morning. But when you enter that classroom, you've got to head to toe, like, be watching every single move, every single word that comes out your mouth, because you are conducting a class with everything that you do.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to use a football analogy. Shall I do it?
Oh, it's quite early. Well, it's quite early, yeah. 12 minutes in.
Every
first
episode.
One.
Every episode. They're like football managers. You got to know which kids need an arm around their shoulder, which kids maybe react to a bit more sort of discipline. But actually, the point of, I was going to say the football thing, and then you were talking, and I realised there's a really important part, and actually, this is really prescient with what's going on at the moment with a lot of the unions and strikes, that teachers are people. And I think sometimes people forget that and think that they are almost like sort of robots who are just there to sort of dole out information. They're not. They are people as well. And they have the same emotions that the kids have, that the parents have. And I think at the moment it feels a little bit like, I was going to say people, politicians, but maybe people influenced by politicians. I've kind of forgotten that in the way they talk about teachers at the moment.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, I feel like what I'm about to say, some people might not like it, but I'm going to say it because I do believe it. And having, like, I've been a teacher for my entire adult life, so I know what that job entails. And I feel like a lot of the time they are just seen as free babysitters. It's because they're free in this country, as in you can send your child, the majority of us send our children to school for free. So it's not something that is valued. And I remember, so my brother, who is also a teacher, is he's disabled, and he has no immune system. And I remember in the midst of like COVID-19, the middle of the pandemic, it was during the lockdown, and there were all these talks where people didn't want to look after their children anymore because they had their child at home and they actually had to attempt to teach their child even like online learning and do their homework with them and have them. They hated it, and they were like, send them back to school, open up the schools. And there was all this talk of like, maybe teachers should be the ones to swab students' throats as they're coming into school in the morning. And it's like watching Wilfred Owen going back into the trenches, and you know what's going to happen. Like, in my house, it was such a terrifying time, because it was like, if my brother has to go back to school and be swabbing possibly infected throats and be locked in a classroom with 32 children, and that's going to be really, really dangerous. But no one cares at that point, because like, just give them to teachers. That's their job. They don't do anything anyway. They get holidays. So you don't want to look after your one child, to just chuck 32 of them and give them to a teacher. And they are human beings. Teachers are human beings. They have their own families. They have their own worries and fears and hopes and dreams. And they have bad days and good days. And they're also going through the pandemic. But everyone forgot that, because everyone free mixed at Christmas and then thought, oh, don't fancy having my child at home anymore. Send them to school. And the way teachers are treated in this country is absolutely appalling. It's absolutely appalling. In this, I get really emotional. I'm so sorry.
No, you don't.
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying.
When in my old school, this is pre-pandemic, so imagine how much worse it is now. So we used to have a sort of almost a police station on site. We used to have our own two police officers just to make sure that like everything was okay with our students. And then the budget cuts were happening because my 10 years in teaching correlated with a decade of austerity in Britain. So then we didn't have our own police officers anymore and we had to share them with like three other schools. So we'd have a police officer twice a week. So then it became the duty of regular teachers to patrol the high road and the bus stops after school, just in case a fight broke out or just in case there was any sort of incident. When you become a teacher, when I qualified, I thought I'm going to be teaching English. I thought I'm going to be teaching students, helping them pass their exams and make them love literature, hopefully a bit of Shakespeare. I never signed up to be putting my own life at risk and be seeing if there's any potential knife crime going on the high road and taking that responsibility. Teachers are not just, I mean, we always talk about workload and I can talk about that all day long. It's like the most amount of overtime you will ever imagine and it's not accounted for, it's not paid for. But on top of that, you hold so many different roles and responsibilities and people are clueless. Absolutely, everyone has an opinion on teachers in schools and everyone wants to talk about teaching strikes and they have no idea the emotional toll and the physical and it's one of the hardest jobs in the world. And that's why there's a problem with teacher retention. That's why everyone leaves and goes to different countries or leaves the profession altogether. But people don't realize. That's my teacher rant for you.
No, completely. It really speaks to me because obviously my wife's a teacher and I know we can obviously share notes on lots of things there. I mean, like the other day she came home, she goes, I didn't, you know, when I became a teacher, I didn't think I was going to become a social worker and a security guard and all those other things, like you say, that entails being a modern day teacher in this country. Plus, like you say, the workload is unbelievable. I mean, you know, she works 4 days a week, most weeks. She's doing 60 plus hours. Easy.
Where did my 20s go? Where did my 20s go? Everywhere I went, if my friends were getting married, if we had family come over, I would carry my box of marking. I kid you not, my box of marking with me. And it wouldn't always get done. But you have this eternal guilt because you will never catch up. But you're like, I really should be marking. You carry that everywhere. And you're always waiting for the next half term so you can catch up, waiting for the next half term. And before I knew it, I turned 30 with no kids of my own. I worked in a department of kind of 30 women. In our English faculty, we had about 30 women. And either none of them were married or they were divorced or they didn't have children. Because when do you do that? When do you have time to take some time for your own personal life? You don't. I had something else I was going to share. Oh, yeah, I was going to say it again. And I talk about both these incidents in my book, and something very similar happened the other day, and I cried and I cried and I cried, and my sister was like, you should write another book. When I was teaching, and this is, imagine you're just like a young woman in her 20s still trying to kind of find your own feet and your own like place in the world. And I remember this one time, cut a long story short, but one of my students, we got called for an emergency meeting at sort of 10:15 in the morning, and I found out one of my students who was on report for his punctuality, was running for the bus in the morning and he got hit by a bus and he died. Oh, 15 God. Minutes later, I had to go and stand in front of a class and teach like nothing had happened. A few years after that, one of my favorite students who I knew the family so deeply and I worked with, I taught his older brother, I taught his younger sister, I knew mum so well. He ended up getting excluded. And a couple of years after that, I was sent a news article and he had been given a life sentence for murder. And you think, what on earth happened in that time that a top set student gets excluded? What happens? What could I have done differently? Those things, you're getting like those punches are happening all the time and you've still got to go and perform. you've still got to go. And all those things we were talking about earlier, about watching every word that comes out of your mouth, make sure you are on top form, because you are the escapism that the kids are walking into to get away from whatever challenges and issues they're facing outside. It's a lot. It is a lot. It is draining. It is exhausting. It's a lot.
I'm so sorry to hear that. That is really sad, really, really sad, both those stories. And, you know, you're both right about the multiple roles that teachers take on, that I think, I was going to use the phrase that people take the piss out of a bit, I think, or certainly I think maybe the government do, and don't really appreciate the multiple roles that teachers do. And I was going to ask a question, which was, in fact, there's two prongs to the question, actually, because the first one was, do we think that government people, parents, maybe have that view on teachers because, look, they're doing something they love, and when you do something you love, you have to end up going beyond. It's like being an actor. You have to be badly paid because you're doing what you love, and so that's just the way it is. And I wonder if people think of that as teachers in the same way, because, oh, look, their heart's in it, so we can push them a bit further, we can get them to do more. But also, and I'm sure the answer to this is no, but is there much mental health support for teachers? Because even just those two stories alone that you've mentioned is enough to really, really, tear someone down. But there must be multiple stories like that that teachers go through in their careers. But I'm imagining you're going to say the mental health support probably isn't that great.
Mental health support doesn't exist, because everyone's go-to is that you get enough holidays and you just read from a textbook anyway. My ex used to say to me, when I was training to be a teacher, and it felt like I'd been hit by a brick, and I was like, couldn't keep my eyes open past 7 p.m. And he's like, all you do is read from a textbook anyway. Why are you so tired all the time? So I think, going actually to your first question of why do you think people take the piss out of teachers, is because it's probably partly because you think, oh, but you're doing it for the children, so you should. But I think more so it's because people just have no idea. When you look from the outside, and also how teaching used to be, perhaps back in the day when I was at school, maybe there was a lot more kind of, I remember like in maths, we did do a lot of, here's a textbook, turn to like this page and just work through it, answers at the back. Sometimes there was. But it doesn't work like that anymore, because we've got obviously bigger class sizes, we've got fewer resources, we've got all of that stuff happening, but also teaching has changed, I think, and developed as a profession, and we plan lessons differently now. And I mean, don't get me started on Ofsted and inspections, all that kind of stuff. But I think people just have no idea. You can explain it all day long and it just sounds like teachers moaning again. And until you actually go and try and teach yourself, you know, just the idea of standing in front of 30 teenagers, like, just do that. Forget the workload, forget the emotional stuff, forget all of that. Try standing in front of 30 teenagers a few times in one day, and that will give you the smallest taster that you need to see how difficult this job is. It is not an easy task. It is not for the weak-hearted to be able to stand in front of 30 teenagers and let alone try and make them learn something. I think they can take the piss with teachers because they actually have no idea what it's like, and they will never, ever know. And a lot of the people in power have never even stepped foot inside a state school. When you haven't stepped foot inside a state school, and when you have gone yourself to private schools where classes were of 10 and below, when you yourself were, you have absolutely no idea. You cannot even fathom, you cannot imagine, you cannot empathize what it's like to go to or be teaching at, and for example, in a London state comprehensive.
Yeah.
And the people who make decisions, the people who make decisions about what happens in schools and what happens with teachers, are people who have never stepped foot into a state school themselves.
It's beyond me why, and this is, you know, all governments, but this particular one, don't have people who have had experience in those industries doing those, like, you know, why have we not got people who are in charge of the NHS who have had experience of working in the NHS? You know, I mean, it's potty. It's absolutely potty that's not a thing.
I can't. It makes absolutely no sense. But because when you are doing a job simply to get the money and the power and the status that comes with that job rather than actually for the people, why would you care? Give it to your mate. Give it to people within that circle. Give a job, an NHS job, to someone who actually knows about the NHS? Why would you make an education secretary someone who actually knows about education, has probably worked in that sector? Why would you do that? You don't need to. When you don't invest in schools and education, which is the bare minimum we should be doing as such a developed, advanced country, if you don't invest in schools and education and young people, they are going to grow up in a few years and be adults, and you've got a whole society filled with adults who were not given proper support in any sense, not for their mental health, not in their education. And you have an increase in poverty, you have an increase in crime, and that eventually filters out into the world you're living in. And that's what we're seeing happening slowly.
Completely agree. We're seeing the effects of 12 years of Tory government, essentially. Should we move on?
Yeah.
Because I feel like we could genuinely talk about this all day. And I'm sure we've got a lot of people listening that would echo these views. And, you know, if you haven't already gathered from the first 27 minutes of this podcast, we support all teachers, especially teachers striking. We support them in every way. How did the presenting come about? Because actually, I was wondering if actually being a teacher and, you know, some of the stories you've been talking about there, and you are connecting to people, you're dealing with people, you're having to deal with people from different backgrounds on various different levels, that actually are probably really good skills for going into presenting.
Yeah, it happened completely by chance. It was never part of the plan. I was really happy as a teacher. I'd been promoted in my first 5 years. It was like, I loved it. I was exhausted. I was unwell, but I loved it. And then one morning, I'll tell you the longer version of the story, actually. So I had another teacher in the classroom next to me, and she might have been training at the time, but she came in. She was another young South Asian woman, and she was crying her eyes out at 7 a.m. and I thought, what on earth has happened? I thought someone had died, like the way she was crying. And I sat with her for like half an hour, and I said, what's the matter? And finally she said, my cousin's getting married. And I said, so why are you crying? And she said, because I'm not married. And started crying. And I think we must have been about, 27 at the time, maybe. And that morning, I don't know what possessed me. I don't know what made me do it. You don't usually even have time to like go for a wee. But I had a free period that morning, and I went to the English office and I wrote. They say I used to be a blogger, but I didn't even know what blogging was. I didn't have any social media at the time. I just wrote an article called Why I'm Not Married. It was nothing profound. It was simply my experience of my views on marriage as a young British Muslim Pakistani woman who is like heading towards her 30s. And that evening I put it up on the internet for my friends to see it, because I thought, this is good. I haven't written in ages, and this is a really good piece of writing. Went to sleep, and the next morning people in Kazakhstan and Uganda were reading it, and it was everywhere. And the BBC had left a comment on it and said, can you please get in touch? We want to talk to you about a new show that's in development. And I got really excited. And I called them, and they pitched the idea of Muslims Like Us to me. And it sounded like a Muslim Big Brother. You're going to go and live in a house, which is fine if that's what people want to do, but it's not what I want to do. So I said, I'm sorry, I don't want to do it. I declined. And they were really persistent, which I'm really grateful for now, but they wouldn't let go. Mubin, as I was, I think the exec producer at the time, and he was like, let me come to your house. I'm going to speak to your family and you about anything that you are anxious about. And I said, all right, fine. So he came to my house a few times. This went on for about 3 months. And on the third visit, he really got on with my dad. And on the third visit, when he left, my dad said, what are you worried about? Why do you keep saying no to this? And I said, look, I know I'm Muslim. I know how Muslims are presented in the media. They are going to put me in a house with people who view Islam in a very different way and practice Islam in a very different way to me. They're all going to shout at me and tell me, you can't be Muslim because you got your nails done. And that's not fun. Why would I want to do that? And my dad said, I'll never forget, he said, I didn't raise you to be weak. I didn't raise you to be stupid. And he was like, you only get opportunities only come around once and you need to grab it. And I feel like you could do something really great if you get yourself a platform. He said, if you want to help children and young people and make a difference, do it on a bigger scale. This is your chance. And that day I phoned Mabeen and I said, I'll do it. So I Hannah Montana'd it for nearly a year. My head teacher was incredible and gave me some time off to go and film Muslims Like Us. It won a BAFTA. I was doing a BAFTA speech one night, staring into Benedict Cumberbatch's eyes. And the next morning, I was doing a year 11 GCSE masterclass at 7 o'clock. And then it got to a point because, you know, I wasn't born into money. So it wasn't like, you know, go and give this a shot. And if it doesn't work out, it's fine. I couldn't quit my job until I knew I was onto something here. But post BAFTA speech, obviously, it was like, you need to get an agent, you need to do this. And people were giving me, and Muslims were very in fashion in the media at that point. A Channel 4 was doing a little Muslim show. Everyone wanted to talk about being Muslim. So it was the right time, really. And that September I resigned because I thought I have to pick one. I can't continue doing both. And I started presenting. And I remember when I led my first documentary, they were like, are you nervous? Are you scared, Maureen? And I said, I teach teenagers for a living. Nothing. Yeah. Nothing can scare me. It's weird. I look back at myself then, like 4 years ago, whatever it was. And I was so sure of myself. I was so confident in my ability and who I was and what I stood for and what I wanted to do. I was, and teaching had built me to be like that. When you're guiding children like under your wing as this super mum every day of your life, nothing can scare you. And I remember when I started my telly journey, I felt like, piece of piss, I could do this. Yeah. Then it all went downhill.
I was going to say, that sounds like you're leading up to say, but now things are different.
Yeah. I think I was going to be really dramatic and say, I think the industry's broken me a little bit. I wouldn't say I'm broken, but I definitely think it's thoroughly unpleasant. And I think I am glad that I made the move, because I think if I was 33 and I was still teaching every day and still wasn't married, didn't have children, was just going in every day and teaching, exhausted, no time to brush my hair, maybe I'd feel like, God, I never experienced anything else. Maybe I could have done more. Maybe I could have done something different. So I'm really glad I've made the move. And I've had really, really wonderful opportunities along the way, which hopefully will carry on happening. And I'll keep working hard and trying to make that happen. But I think this is an industry that's built on insecurity, and it's built on parading people for 10 minutes and saying, you're the best thing ever. And then saying, times have changed, get to the back of the queue and we'll come back to you when we're ready again. I don't think it's always based on kind of merit and hard work and talent. It's whoever has the most views on YouTube for doing something outrageous, or whoever's been on Love Island, or whoever's, it could be a million different things that you're not actually in control of. At least in teaching, if I planned a really good lesson, obviously depending on like the kids' mood that day, but if I work really hard, I can get a promotion. If it's stable and it's secure. But TV's not like that. This media industry isn't like that. I can work day and night, but if the commissioners don't fancy me at that particular point in time, I'm not going to have work. And I find that quite difficult. And then, I don't know, I was kind of living the high life, and then COVID happened. So that was the first kind of, oh my God, like TV has stopped. My 4 projects that were in development have all been indefinitely postponed and cancelled. What do I do? So that was my first wobble, and I was only 2 years in or something, but I made it work. And I was kind of, I feel like, again, if that hadn't happened, I didn't have that kind of low point in TV, I would have never done my Radio 4 podcast, Secret Life of Teachers, which then led on to my book. And writing is my life. Like, I was reading before I could do anything else. So that was amazing. But then my father got really sick about a year ago. He got COVID. I don't know if you're aware already. He got COVID and essentially ended up on a ventilator. And the doctor said he's got 6 hours left to live. He was in a red list country at the time. And it was 48 hours before my book launch, which I thought in my head was like my big comeback. And I thought, I'm going to be back on telly. I'm going to be doing all these promotion things. And I'll be back in everyone's eye again. And it's going to, off the back of my book, I'll get back onto doing my documentaries. And it was all kind of planned and done. And I had to fly out to Red List Pakistan. And I didn't even know if he'd be alive by the time I got there. And I think that was a really, I don't know, a really, a strange time, but also a kind of groundbreaking time for me, because it really made me reflect on everything. It had been so fast, you know, like I'm teaching, my 20s have flown by, I'm teaching every day, every day, every day. And then I start presenting while I'm teaching, and then I leave teaching just as I'm presenting full time. And it was, I'm writing a book in 12 weeks. And suddenly I'm there. My dad's about to die. No one gives a fuck, because all the friends that you've made in this industry are not friends. They are just people looking for the next talent, really. They don't really care. And I remember I thought, if I come back, I'm going to have to do the quarantine hotel, which is how many thousands of pounds. And A, I can't afford that. And B, I'd really like to get back and promote my book and not spend like 2 weeks or whatever in a quarantine hotel. And I really think that made me reevaluate everything. And then meanwhile, obviously, sorry, I'm talking loads. Stop me whenever you need to. At the same time, there are hardly any, like less than a handful of brown women on telly, on mainstream TV. So at the same time, where I knew exactly who I was and what I stood for, and I was really inspiring as a teacher, but suddenly I was talking about faith. I'm doing Muslims Like Us, Islam Women and Me, Lost Boys about Asian men. And I just got like the backlash that you get, because there are all eyes are on you. When there aren't many of you doing what you're doing, then the whole community looks at you to see whether you represent them. You can't talk about your own story. You've got to represent all of them. And if you say anything vaguely like that may come across as criticism or questioning, it's like you had an opportunity to show us in a good light and you're a sellout. And so all of that kind of also makes you, because the next time you do a show, you're like, God, I've got to be even more careful of every word that's coming out of my mouth. Like I've really, so where my first show, I was just me. I was like, actually, me gets a lot of hate. Maybe I need to like rephrase this. Maybe I need to hold back. I remember we were filming a show in out of London, and these five young men in a car identified me as the girl from the BBC, and they essentially attacked us in the middle of filming, and we had to get in a car and run away. They tried to run us over with their car and Snapchatted all of it, and all of those kind of things are happening. So it's bad enough when you're like on the street as a young woman and you're filming and people are shouting out sort of sexual noises and stuff at you, but then top that up with like every time a show comes out, you're either being told to come, go back to where you come from. I was born and brought up here. Like, where are you telling me to go back to? Or you got the other half of the people saying you're a sellout and why do you work for the BBC and you're doing, like, it's impossible. And that bit got easier because you end up not giving a shit anymore. And you're like, actually, I'm going to revert back to just being me. And that's got to be enough. But all of those things, if you put them on top of each other, it's tough.
Yeah, and especially if you're in an industry, then when you do reach out for help, no one's answering that call. And you're totally right about that industry. And I wonder if actually, you know, nothing's forever. You know, no career or anything's forever. And the fact that you came to it later, I think maybe does it give you more perspective?
I often think, thank goodness I had a proper career and I was a big grown woman before I joined this industry, because it means I'm that little bit wiser, stronger, able to reflect and able to move on from things when I know they aren't serving me in a positive way and all that kind of stuff, which comes from A, being older, B, having a really strong support network of like family and close friends and things like that. But not everyone has that. I think about people who go into this industry when they are so that like, they're young and they are naive and they are impressionable and they are not as built, and they may not have that support system. And I just, it must be absolutely awful. I've ruined the whole mood of the podcast, haven't I?
Not at all. No. This is really important to hear, because a lot of people won't be aware. Of what this, you know, because it looks all sparkly and lovely from the outside.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not sparkly. And like I say, I don't, there are, I don't want to seem ungrateful for the opportunity I did have,
of
because I've
that,
done really, like, I was able to take my parents to Hajj, to pilgrimage, with the money that I made in my first year. That was amazing. And I wouldn't have been able to do that had I not changed from teaching, because with teaching, you can't even pay your rent. I was, you know, kayaking with Adrian Childs, and I flew a little helicopter by myself. And I, like, things like that, you just think, wow, I feel like I've experienced so much more of life than I would have. And, but, you know, life happens, and it inevitably changes you. And it's just weird when I look back at that first show, I watch Muslims Like Us, and I'm like, I'm so not that girl anymore. Like, life has happened. It's not just TV. It's also my father's illness. It's also just life has happened. But being in TV has not made it any easier.
I think, to be honest, talking honestly, I think is always the way to go anyway, to be honest. But
I'm a bit sick of just not being able to say anything. You know, you can't say anything because you're going to end up getting yourself blacklisted. You're going to offend people. You're going to... It's like, but it's the truth. Why don't we talk about the truth? It's, you know, I'm not saying everyone's evil, and I'm not saying anyone owes me work, and I'm not saying... I'm just talking about my experience, and that is the truth of, like, how it has been for me and probably for countless others. Why can't we talk about that?
Well, I think it's the support thing that is the most sort of disheartening as well. That you not, there's like literally no support there for you. You know,
I also but the race element is just awful.
Of course, that is awful as well. Yes.
No, but also when I first started in TV, I had another British Muslim Pakistani woman who then became my mentor, taught me how to get an agent, taught me, commissioned the first few of my shows, championed me. But then when she left, like, I shouldn't have to wait for the next brown person to come and champion me again. Like, we talk about diversity pots and we talk about all of this kind of stuff, but no, not really. Why are we waiting for the next Muslim story for me to be able to cover? Like, it's not. Or if I pitch something I really want to talk about and it's like, well, you know, you don't really have a personal link to that enough. I was told I don't have a personal, like, what is Maureen's personal link to this when I wanted to do something in schools? But when Louis Theroux talks about anorexia, has he suffered with it himself? Or when Stacey Dooley goes and talks about whatever, she doesn't have to. The double standards and the absolute, like, poor way we treat diversity in this industry is shameful.
I do think a lot of organisations are, perhaps say, lying to themselves. That feels strong. Maybe it's true, actually, about how good they are at diversity. Or, for example, when it was International Women's Day the other day, there's a fantastic account on Twitter. It's a bot of some sort, and it retweets every organisation that says, "Happy International Women's Day," and says, the pay parity in this institution is 50% lower for women, etc. And it basically calls out nearly all of them. Yeah. Are lower for women, and they're all going out there going, "Happy International Women's Day." And I think it's probably the same with diversity. I think a lot of organisations, I don't know whether they think they're doing well and they're not, or they're lying to themselves, or they're lying to everyone else, but it's nearly always a bit of a smokescreen.
Yeah, 100%. And I think there's only room for one type of diversity at a time. So you just got to wait your turn.
Yeah, it's... Do you feel sort of feel like you get sort of pigeonholed then?
I was completely pigeonholed in my first year. Everything I was getting was like, as a Muslim woman, you know, doing something about Lucozade. As a Muslim woman, Maureen loves Lucozade. It was ridiculous. Mm. And then I kind of made a real conscious effort to break out of that. So then I started doing a lot of, I was given lots of fish out of water. Maureen's from London. She's never seen trees before. We're going to send her to talk about trees, and we're going to send her to the countryside and make her see salmon. And I was like, wow, animals. And I thought, God, why have I dumbed myself down? So it's fun for a bit. It's funny for a bit, but I'm a teacher. I really can't be playing this. Wow, salmon. Like, I can't be playing that forever. So then we kind of reevaluated everything again. And I said, I really want to talk about other things. And I ended up doing a year of The Wealth Gap. So we looked at Inside Chelsea, which was a really lovely doc, actually. I'm really proud of that one. Looking at the wealth gap in London, in a borough in London. And then I did, like, The Truth About Cosmetic Treatments, because we're looking more at body image and things. So it was starting to go in the right direction. Because also, don't forget, like, I didn't know anything about TV. So I was very much learning the craft. Mm. When people were saying, do a vox pop, I was like, what's a vox pop?
Vox pops are horrible.
Yeah, so the first, I really enjoy them. The first couple of years, I was very much just sort of learning and sort of realizing that actually I can write a bit of my own com and I can. So just when I was saying, well, now I should start thinking about what I want my body of work to look like. What do I actually, you know, what do I actually want to do rather than ideas that are just coming to me? COVID happened.
Yeah, bad timing. I have to admit, you're definitely made for what you're doing then, because I used to hate doing vox pops when I was a local reporter. I used to hate them so
Why?
Much. I don't know.
Talking maybe to the public, now. Is it?
Yeah, maybe it's different now, I don't know. But like then I just hate approaching people and like accosting them. And but it was always really dumb questions like, what do you think about the potholes on Main Street? You know, stuff like that, stuff no one cares about. But
I love that. Yeah, I think that's... normal people are... It's like, I love teenagers because there are no mind games. It's like, if they like you, I say this line in my book and I say, if they like you, they'll get you a best teacher mug. If they hate you, they'll throw a chair at you. There's no mind games. There's no reading between the lines. And I think similar with vox pops, like rather than talking to people about, I don't know, I was at an event recently and they were all talking about rhubarb. And thought, is rhubarb back in fashion? I didn't realize rhubarb. I was like, what are you talking about? Vox pops, you just get the regular person walking down, going about their daily business, affected by the cost of living crisis, have a chat with them. Like, I much prefer that.
It's a bit more real.
Yeah.
So I'd have two things I wanted to ask for earlier. Firstly, Hannah Montanaing it. Love that. Never heard that before. Love that as a phrase. Definitely going to be starting to use that. That's super.
Yeah, that's great.
When you were still teaching, but you were getting the BAFTA and that stuff was starting to roll on, did that give you more credit with the kids at school? Surely that must have bought you some credit.
Do you know, a lot of our kids didn't watch TV, so they kind of knew. They kind of knew because someone had heard or something like that. So yeah, some of them knew, and it was kind of cool because, like, oh, teacher, are you famous? But it wasn't that big a deal because no one watches documentaries of, like, as in no one in my school at that point watched documentaries. So it wasn't, yeah, sometimes they say, oh, miss, I was like, my mum was going through the TV and then you were on it and it was quite cool. But I was a really cool teacher. I didn't need TV to give me that extra kind of credit. I already had that.
The right answer.
It's funny, actually, like going to the parents' evening last night, all the teachers are brilliant, obviously, but you can sort of pick out the cool ones. Like, oh yeah, they're cool. You
what, because they're wearing a leather jacket or something?
Or no, just like a vibe, just like an energy about them.
And sometimes it's not. Everyone thinks, oh, is it like, it's because you're young, it's because you're attractive.
Yes. No.
And actually it's not. There are a lot of young, attractive teachers who kids hate. Because it might be exciting for the first day where everyone has a little giggle because you've got a fit teacher, but it wears off very quickly. Sometimes it's like super old teachers who just, they just got, I think kids can really tell when a teacher really cares about them. I think they've got a real, they can sniff it out. They can tell when you are just trying to be an arse, and when you're just trying to be a dictator, when you're just trying to, and they can tell when you're saying something for their own benefit because you really care about them.
Yeah,
and absolutely. kids, every kid wants to hear that, surely. Even kids that come in and maybe they're a bit bullshit or whatever, and they're giving off a vibe of don't give a fuck about anything. Every kid wants to be appreciated. Well, we all do as humans, listened to, validated, seen. And I think teachers that can do that, I mean, my God, that's a real skill.
Yeah, the ones who, the kids who seem like they don't give a anything are the ones who probably need love the most.
Yeah,
most of the time it's the ones who don't turn up to parents evening who need that parents evening the most. It's the one, like, yeah,
going on to your, obviously, your later projects like the podcast and writing, it feels like you may be getting a bit more autonomy on your creative career doing those kind of things. Has that been enjoyable, kind of doing of your own stuff?
Yes, it's been enjoyable and it's been intentional. It feels really great to be able to do things that are in my own words and my own voice.
Yeah.
Because often in TV, you are the face of something, but then everything you shoot for 6 months gets condensed into 60 minutes, and then someone else writes your comm, and someone else edits, and someone else. And by the time it's gone through all those layers, you watch it, and you're like, even you don't know what you're about to watch. And you are just the face of it. Whereas writing my book, I had the most wonderful, wonderful editor, and we had a bit of a bidding war for my book. But the reason why I went with her is because she gave me just full and complete ownership. And she was like, literally, she would make some changes and suggestions, but she'd be like, if you can ignore all of them if you want to, because this is your story. These are your words. And that was the most beautiful. That's why that book is so close to my heart, because that is my baby. That is my words. That is my life. It's part memoir. It's literally my story. You can't take it out of context, really, as in I can't blame anyone else. Everything I say in that, I stand by 100%, because it's genuinely how I feel. It's no one else's kind of input. And equally with Secret Life of Teachers, the podcast, literally it was like that time when I was explaining that we were like, our teacher's going to go back to school. My brother and sister, are they going to have to go back into COVID land? And what's going to happen? And schools were in the headlines. Everyone was talking about the government was introducing, we might have bubbles, and we're going to put a one-way system into schools because all the kids are going to follow the one-way system and all this kind of nonsense. And I was lying in bed, as I usually do at 2 a.m. and I can't sleep and my mind is in overdrive. And I thought, I want to do a podcast where I get teachers to sit down and have a chat. And I want people to hear these chats. I want them to hear the chats that we have at the dining table, because with a family that's deeply rooted in education, when we have our friends come over, my best friend's a teacher, when we have everyone come over, I want people to hear those real conversations, not the headlines, not the government's plans. And I wrote out a one pager about exactly what I want that podcast to look like, sent it to the BBC the next morning, same day it got the green light. And yeah, it was wonderful, because it was literally majority my family, friends, but also we got other teachers from other walks of life. It was a bit annoying we couldn't do it in person, so it was on Zoom, which delays everything a little bit, but it was great. I love the fact that I'm finally kind of merging my two worlds together. So even with my new project with Glow Up Your Grades, I am mixing my presenting with my teaching, and I'm able to do something which feels a bit more rewarding and like it's got a bit of soul and heart in it. It feels like it's making a difference, but I'm not going back into a school. I don't feel like I'm moving backwards. So I feel like I'm definitely in some sort of liminal stage, and I feel like I'm definitely on some sort of journey where dots are slowly adding up and leading towards something. But I'm at that point where I don't actually know what that something is right now. Is it going to be writing more books straight away? Is it going to be doing more of this kind of Glow Up Your Grades teaching resources and resources for young people, mental health, well-being, that kind of stuff? Is it going to be something completely different? I don't really know at this point in time. Am I going to carry on TV for a bit and see if I can totally smash it and buy a big house? I don't know.
Well, you are smashing it. And I think it's those kind of, and I know that very well from being a freelancer, that this sort of combo of emotion of excitement and maybe anxiety of what could happen, what could not, but often you have to sort of ride the wave of those emotions really when you're sort of freelance, and especially in this industry.
Yeah.
But you are smashing it.
Thank you. It's a constant hustle, isn't it? It's a constant grind. Obviously, it's the freelance life of if you don't work, you don't get paid, so you've got to find work. But it's also this constant 2 a.m. wake up, I'm going to write a book. 2 a.m. Wake up, I'm going to start a podcast. And it's that constant. It's a lot, but it's becoming more exciting. And I feel like after a long time, I feel strangely at peace with the journey again. And I kind of feel it's got to work out at some point. All of this grinding and hustling, all of this hard work, all of this being put through shit sometimes, all of this having the best intentions and always having a greater purpose of wanting to help people, which has always been in me, it's got to all add up at some point. So I feel less anxious and less stressed for the last few months, and I feel a bit more I'm going to make something happen. Just need to figure out what that something is.
I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will. It will probably become apparent without you even realizing it.
We'll see.
Well, I was going to say, but I mean, I think that's a good way to approach things, but also think about how many kids will have watched Glow Up Your Grades, and maybe it helps them with an exam, or someone reads a book, someone listens to the podcast, it changes the way they think. It's already working out. It's already making a difference, you know, just by those things.
I think with Glow Up Your Grades, it was something that I wanted to do for so long, because there's one me, and as much as I volunteer in places, because I was an examiner for like most of my teaching career as well. So if there's one thing I know I'm bloody good at, is teaching. I can make kids pass. I can make them like English. I can make them pass. And I wanted to do that on a bigger scale. And I wanted to create these kind of videos to, if kids can't afford a private tutor, I wouldn't have been able to when I was younger, they should have their own teacher, a teacher who's going to take them through it. And also a generation that's brought up on social media. I want it to feel young, and I want it to feel engaging, and I want it to be on it. They can watch it on their device and all of that kind of stuff. I don't know how. Sometimes, see, this podcast is really great for me. Sometimes reflection is a great thing, and maybe I don't do it enough. I wanted it for so long, and then suddenly I just thought, a few months ago, I was volunteering at this Saturday school, and the kids were like, I said, oh, well, let's talk about this poem. What's it about? And they had no idea. And I was like, it's literally a couple of months before GCSEs. How do you not know even what this poem is about? And they were like, Miss, we did that in year 10 when we were learning online. We actually don't know what this poem is about. And I thought, oh, my God. Now that's it. I'm doing these videos. I'm making it happen. But how do you do it? I don't know how to use the camera. I don't know how to edit. So I started applying for funding. And I was like applying to all these long forms. I hate forms. Filling out all these long forms. Trying to get funding. Getting rejected. Sorry, we're focusing on primary education. Sorry, we're doing blah, blah, blah. I thought, this is a nightmare. What's going to happen? And I thought, do you know what? I'm going to use the last of my savings. And I'm going to make these videos. And I contacted my agent. And I said, do you know anyone who can operate a camera and can help me make these videos so that I can put them out there before these GCSEs and the kids can learn what these poems are about? He said, yes, I know this guy. He'll do it. And I think it was like £3,000 or £4,000. And I thought, it's going to have to be an investment. I'm just going to have to do it because I really need to do this. It was one of those, again, it was like post-dad's illness. It was like, I have to do something, which feels like I'm doing something again. And I was literally about to sign the contract and say, yep, we're doing this. I'm paying you this money. We're making the videos. And just by chance, this guy I know said, speak to this company. They might be able to help you. I jumped on 10 minutes later to a Zoom with that company. And the same day they said, yep, we want to do this. We'll invest however much money, more than I could have ever afforded. And Glow Up Your Grades happened. And now I get messages every single day. I'm going to put some up actually on my socials tonight. I get messages every single day of students who are making pages and pages of notes using those videos, and parents and teachers who are using, like, who are saying that their children didn't know X, Y, and Z, but they've just spent the whole day watching these videos and look at these notes that they've made. And it is the best bloody feeling ever. And do you know what? I did that. I bloody did that. I sat down one day and I thought, I'm going to do this. And I have so made that happen. If there's one child who will end up passing and being able to move on to higher education from those videos, that's a bloody good job.
There's a little catchphrase on this podcast, which we use quite a lot of time. And it's give yourself the wins. And I think, you know, that's a big win you can give yourself.
That's a big win. There have been some good wins. You know what? I feel like I often talk about all the bad points. But there have been there have been wins. I was brought up on a council estate. We didn't even have like a stable home. We moved house all the time. I went to how many different schools? There was no foot in the door. There was no network that would help me. There was nothing. I ended up on mainstream BBC One and BBC Two. That was off my own bloody back. Like, give credit, and I don't think I get enough credit for the fact that I was leading mainstream as a brown 20-something-year-old woman, working class, like I say, no contacts, no anything. That was a pretty incredible achievement in itself. And the fact that now I've got my book. I've got a book. You can go and buy my book. My story, whether no one, like, if no one ever buys it ever again, but it's out there, like, in 100 years' time, someone will be able to find out about my life from that book. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, really, and it's really nice hearing you say that. It's really, really nice hearing you vocalize that and say it out loud, because you are an inspiration. And what I love, and just listening to you from the last, well, actually the whole podcast, a certain last 10, 15 minutes, is you lead with your heart. You clearly lead with your heart and you do things that are important to you. And I think that really reflects back in the things you do. And it's lovely to hear. And I've literally got a tab open now to buy your book as well, which is what I was doing while you were talking there. So, yeah, you are fantastic.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I think I come from a really, really, really great family. I've got, my family has brought, my parents have brought me up, and my older brothers, I'm the baby. My brother's 12 years older than me. My sister's 8 years older than me. And they always said, you don't chase money, you don't chase fame, because all of those things, A, don't get you respect, and B, that you can lose them at any time. So they always taught us, A, to really value education, and B, to everything you do it to help people, basically. And that is the, and you know what, like sometimes I think maybe if my parents did X, Y, and Z, we'd be living in a really nice house right now. Maybe if, but actually no, what they have always stood by, and their children therefore have always stood by, is that you've got to serve others. And you serve God through serving others. And if that's a, what's the saying? Is it, that's the hill I'm willing to die on? Is that the saying?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm happy to stand by that. If there's nothing else, but I can say, do you know what? I might not have been, I don't know, in Hollywood by the end of it, but I know everything I have done with the purpose of like serving the community, serving the students that I teach, serving my parents, like I've done it with the best of intentions, and I can say that wholeheartedly.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, it's really lovely. Yeah.
Thank you. I really, really, really enjoyed it. That felt so lovely, didn't it? That felt like such a lovely chat.
Mehreen Beg on the Blank podcast there. What a fantastic person. Really, really interesting insight into her experiences in education and then moving into broadcasting as well. Someone with passion for both sectors there and both industries, which really shines through. And I'm very excited to see what she does next. So really appreciate her coming on. Just a fantastic individual and doing a lot of great work, helping a lot of people. So, yeah. Brilliant. Thank you for coming on, Maureen.
Yeah, goodness me. I'd love to her to have been my English teacher at secondary school, because I would have definitely got a lot more out of it, I think. I remember having very kind of passive, I guess is the most kind way of putting it, teachers who weren't necessarily as engaged with the pupils at my old school. But, you know, I think it's just really lovely to see. And obviously, I've got a child that's going through GCSEs at the moment and a wife who's a teacher. So this is something that I'm very kind of keyed into at the moment, particularly our education system, the flaws with our education system, the things that we could be changing for the better. You know, and that's another big debate, obviously. You see sort of education systems around the world that I feel personally would benefit from in this country, particularly like Scandinavian models, where we start a bit late, you know, children start a bit later, and they encompass the arts a lot more. I think we don't do that enough in this country, and we've got a huge creative industry that brings in lots of money. So I think, you know, like actually focusing on those things a bit more than the academic stuff, because not every child is academic. I think that's something, but that's another debate. But it's great to hear from Maureen and like how she sees how things could change a little bit, and how the things she's passionate about. And she's just a really, really engaging person. And yeah, Glow Up Your Grades is fantastic. If anyone's listening and their children are going through GCSEs at the moment and need a little bit extra support, particularly around, for example, my son's in his English, is a lot of focus on poetry, and Maureen does a lot of stuff on poetry and engaging with poetry, which is, you know, not always something that 15-year-olds are that into. So yeah, loads of great stuff with the Glow Up the Grades, which you can find on YouTube. But yeah, just check out her social channels, and you can, you know, lots of really interesting links to various different things in the education system, which I think would be really beneficial for a lot of people.
And also do get her book as well, yes. Which I actually ordered a copy of, went straight to, I'm not sure where I got it from. I tried not to get it from the big place.
That place.
Hidden Lessons. I've had a quick dip into it already, but I'm going to sit down. And my wife, who does drama teaching as well on the side, was like, oh, that looks good. So yeah. I think we're both going to dip into it and check it out. We'll put a link in the show notes below so people can buy a copy of that if they like the sound of it. Hidden Lessons. Do go and growing up on the front line of teaching. That's the full title. Do go and buy that as well and support Maureen in all the work that she does.
Yeah, fantastic, fantastic episode. I'm very pleased to have had her on, and to you know, it's nice when you kind of meet these people for the first time as well, and just having a chin wag with them, and then you find you're on the same page with a lot of stuff, aren't you?
Same page, really very good.
Yeah, I know, I like that.
Good stuff. Another great episode in the can. Looking forward to next week's episode. Mm. We're doing well at the moment, aren't we? We've got some good ones.
Oh, we always try. We always try to get the good ones on.
Yeah, I think we do. Yeah. I think we do. So what's next week? It's the week after Easter. Mm. Nothing special, was it? Anyway, I was just going to say, I hope you have a good week. But I think post-Easter, everyone's probably going to be a bit... Do you know what? It's probably one of those weeks, a bit like post-Christmas, where everyone's a bit like, oh, sort of back to whatever. So whatever you're doing this week, listeners, and you, Giles, do something for yourself. Find a little thing for yourself, be it go for a run or read a book or cinema or whatever. Because I think it's going to be one of those weeks that I think you need to treat yourself, I think.
Well, likewise, Jim. And I think, we've probably all been eating and consuming a lot of chocolate. Yeah, so yes, I'll definitely be getting back on the exercise bike this week.
Yeah, exactly. Do whatever makes you feel good this week and gives you the win, as we say on the pod.
Exactly, gives you the win.
Right, have a good week, mate. I will see you next week.
Indeed.
And remember, don't
get cancelled.
That's the one.
Media Podcast.